What's up? This is No More Normal. I'm Khalil A. Colonna. When Jordan Peele released his phenomenal thriller Get Out in 2017, I went to see it with a bunch of my friends. If you don't know the premise of the film, well, to put it short, it was about a young black man traveling to meet his white girlfriend's family for the first time. I won't ruin the movie for you, but the title Get Out is less advice and more of a solid plan. Walking into the theater, I noticed something. We were the only black people there. I remember everyone's faces as we walked toward the back row of seats. Expressions that said, oh snap, a bunch of black guys are coming to see this movie. What's gonna happen? Well, we watched the film and we really enjoyed it. We laughed hilariously at parts when others didn't. Call it shared similar experiences. White Americans see black people portrayed in only a few familiar boxes of expression and stereotypes. Truth is, we encompass a wide diaspora of identity. Today, we look into the quest for African Americans to be seen and the self-determination required to achieve. Oh, and I also talk with my dad.
We have an overall male culture in the community that says education, you know, is good if you get it, but f*** it if you don't. And you can't have that and still be competitive.
I'm on the line with Dr. Charlene Reed. She is the CEO of Excellence Community Schools in New York City. Dr. Reed, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about Excellence Community Schools and its general mission.
The general mission is to provide college prep program, kindergarten through eighth grade, to prepare scholars to be able to succeed and compete in some of our most rigorous, strenuous performing high schools and magnet high schools that we have in the tri-state area. Our goal is to get them into the best high schools, which we know will get them into the best colleges. We have enough data to show that it's been working. Our first graduating class graduated from college this year, 2020.
Wow.
We've actually been able to see our mission actually realized.
Well, congratulations on that. Tell me a little bit more about the community that you all serve.
The original flagship school opened up in, for folks who know a little bit about New York, so the South Bronx. But then 2 years later, the school moved to an area called Parkchester, which is in the East Bronx. And as we've grown and opened up more schools, we have 7 schools around the borough. Our schools are very community-based, but not in the sense that you hear typically with kind of like a community-based school that has all these wraparound services and kind of like what we've known of the last like 20 something years of a community school. We kind of have redefined that to say that we cannot run our school without the community. So in being able to do that, we establish a family partnership at the beginning with the families. They come and meet with the school leaders anywhere between an hour or two, and this is where we really get to know each other. We don't sign a real physical contract, but we are establishing that social contract. We allow families to ask every question in the world because they're sending us their babies. We are establishing what our expectations are, what we expect of each other, with an understanding that we're going to be a family, and that if your child stays with us all the way through eighth grade, they're going to be with us for 9 years. We also have a student advancement department and program where we continue to support our scholars through their high school experience and college. So we have work study, we have scholarship programs, internships. We've given seed money for some of our scholars. They're entrepreneurs, they want to start businesses. Once you sign up with us, we will take you K through 16. Everyone knows great schools are great because everybody in the community is investing in that school to be great.
Yeah.
Local businesses, store owners, big or small, they're a part of that team. When we open up a new school in a new neighborhood, the families wanted us there. We have a partnership with the precinct. The police officers know Bronx Excellence kids. They know what that uniform looks like, and they know what we expect and how they should be treating our scholars and our families, and we work together. They come to the schools all the time to meet the kids. We have partnerships with grocery stores, with local owners. Majority of our vendors are from the borough. So we make sure that we keep the dollar in the borough.
If it takes a community to raise a child, it definitely takes the community to save a child. Talk to me about increased community activity in our schools that's really not being recognized or talked about when it comes to education.
Well, I mean, so often most of society's problems with the youth, they always kind of blame the school or they'll blame the parents. And so I think as an educator, and just speaking for myself, sometimes you just want to come to work and you just want to teach. But it does take a community to come together to be able to have that heavy lift to be able to say, we're not just here educating, but we're also working together to make sure that our community is doing what it needs to do so that we can survive and live and be successful and be happy. And it takes everyone. The schools just can't do it. It's not the responsibility all on the school.
Yeah.
But acknowledging it, getting other folks in the neighborhood, in the community, in that particular neighborhood, especially in Portland and New York, because the neighborhoods are so defined, to get everyone to be a part of it to where it's reciprocal. And then giving the kids the voice and the families the voice. We're the second teachers. The families are the first teachers.
I get you. Education to underserved communities has a lot of common needs across the country. How can the accomplishments that you all have been able to achieve, the principle or philosophies of those, how can that be transferred to other communities and districts that suffer from similar needs?
I'm asked this question all the time as I travel often. There's one thing that cuts across all of our neighborhoods in our community is great schools work because the community piece where everyone in the community is working hand in hand to make sure that that school succeeds. But then also that inside of the schools, I believe deep down in my soul that our schools work really well because every single staff member treats the kids as if those are their own kids. Down from the cafeteria worker to the custodian, the office aide, the school aide, the paraprofessional, the principal, the assistant principal, the teacher. Every student is their son or their daughter, is their granddaughter or their grand, like it's a family. So we all know what we do with our for our own kids. So if you have that same type of motivation and that kind of like dogged attitude when it comes to someone else's kid, then that kid is going to succeed.
Yeah.
You know, like I had a friend the other day said, you know, we don't mess with that parent because she'll bite your head off. Yes, we all know what that means, right?
Yeah.
So if the staff are just like that, then the kids are going to succeed. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
If I believe that you're going to read, you're going to read. And if I fight for you to learn how to read, then you're going to learn how to read.
Tell me, what type of vetting process do teachers and staff go through when they're applying to ECS? Do you check for any biases that educators or staff may have? Do you check for that similar passion that you're speaking about?
Yes, we do. There are certain scenarios that we ask. Over 60% of our staff actually are from the Bronx. So you kind of see like this community commitment already.
I just looked up a study, 2015-2016. It said that 77% of the teacher were women. And a majority of those were white women. So to understand people's biases when it comes to educating the kids and how it affects the youth and the communities is something I think is very important. And I'm just wondering if schools are going to be really emphasizing that now. What should schools do, as your opinion, as a master educator?
I'll just give an example of when we come across that during the interview process. It depends on what type of bias it is, right? So most of our biases are based on our upbringing and how we were raised and how we were nurtured and some of the lessons that we were taught. Usually that will come out with particular type of questions around like, how do students learn? And there are certain things that you're like, no, you can't work here because you fundamentally believe that a child who speaks two languages is going to be a delayed learner. And so that's something that we can't change right now, you know, for you.
Yeah.
But we might have some teachers who this is the first time that they are really around people of color. And so we ask those kind of questions. You know, what are you going to do when a parent does this? Or what are you going to do when a child does this? Or one of the reasons that we take a long time with our interviews is because we like to see if people get annoyed, if they can even take going from person to person. If they can't take that, then they definitely can't work in one of our classrooms.
Yeah.
Like, that's just not going to work.
Yeah, I could attest that running any type of classroom, you have to have an extreme amount of patience. When it comes to history, American history in specific, how do you at Excellence Community Schools go about creating a curriculum that accurately recounts history and the telling of some of the more horrific acts in American history?
Probably like most folks, this summer, our organization, we did do some reflection and almost had our own reckoning where we sat down, actually put a civics engagement group together. And this study was to help us to really reflect on, are we teaching social studies and history in a way that is reflective of every voice, of every perspective? And we were able to say no. we're going to create more of a humanities kind of program. Like, we're going to make a curricular shift. We're going to take a lens to where we're looking at history through multiple perspectives and really taking heed to that timeline. Hmm. That's super important for our children to understand. So when you study World War II, the kids need to understand what was going on in the world during that time, not just from the American perspective and not just the one that we typically talk about. Like, we talk about the Holocaust, we talk about, you know, the different wars and different like battles we have and stuff like that. And then we talk about our heroes and we talk about Pearl Harbor, but we don't talk about what other countries were doing during that time. It was a world war, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But we only talk about the U.S. side of that war, or we don't talk about what it was like for other races and ethnicities to, like, what was going on during that time? What was it like for an African-American man who was fighting in the war? Mm-hmm. You know, what was it like for a Japanese family that had to go into an internment camp in California? Mm-hmm. Like, kids in New York need to know about that. It's not going to be perfect, but I think we're heading in a pathway where I think acknowledging multiple voices and multiple perspectives and just being honest about what was going on at that time, I think will serve our kids so much better than what I experienced in my history classes and things like that.
Yeah, I experienced the same thing. The only thing that cleaned it up for me was coming home and my parents asked me what I learned, and my sisters and I told them. My folks quickly broke out their own history books and told us what was actually correct. Thank you, Mom and Dad, for that. She's Dr. Charlene Reed, CEO of Excellence Community Schools in the Bronx, New York City, and in Connecticut. Dr. Reed, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
I think music is our most persuasive art form. It's definitely the most influential form of entertainment. What's the most popular music of the last few decades? Hip hop. I wanted to talk about hip hop, the COVID-19 remix. So I put a panel together. In order of appearance, we have A. Billy Free, Awad Bilal, Jeff Jazztone Alberson, Sebastian Seb Eckelby, and Roscoe Flo Fader Floyd. Flo Fader gets us right and puts us in the mix. So when you all are creating your music and writing it, do you think about the messages that you're sharing with the world?
Firstly, I make music for myself, but I do understand that it goes out into the public. And so when I'm further crafting my message, I take a look at how to be as universal as possible. I want to hit a middle ground with everyone. And so that is sort of how the Reflecting Social Times would form a message in my music.
This is a lot. I think that all of us are experiencing this in real time. The visibility is in us. I think we are responsible for kind of like making sure that we feel seen. I mean, DC is full of artists. We're a Black city. This is what we do.
But a thought that came to me is that I feel like music in the hip hop sphere, but also in other forms of music, gives a message anyway. And I look at musicians and celebrities who haven't said anything and who have said anything. So for example, like Kendrick Lamar, why does he need to say anything more? He's already said everything in his music. So why is there the pressure for celebrities and musicians to be out in the forefront when they've already spoken on it in their albums and in their artwork?
I think I know when the commercialization of hip hop really and truly began. It was with MC Hammer. MC Hammer had Pepsi deals. He had endorsements that hip hop acts did not have at the time. They already saw that it could sell because of the controversial music. We had the NWA release. We had Two Live Crew and the controversy down in Dade County, Florida. I think that is when it really started.
This is Jeff. The period you're talking about is the period when we started to refer to the music as rap music. You have to think about that. In that same time period as MC Hammer, or whatever else was going on at that time period, we started calling it rap music as it started to chart and compete with what was traditionally known as pop. And they tried to keep it out of the pop charts for a minute by creating a rap chart. Rap, or that terminology, is synergistic with commercial hip-hop music. We even understand the signaling of it. When we're talking about hip-hop, we're thinking about something that might actually have some content to it. that might leave you with some substance. We understand that rap music is for the moment to get an immediate reaction like an Instagram post. But we're talking about hip-hop versus rap music, truthfully. In the early 2000s and late 90s, all of the record companies got bought by alcohol companies selling sex with their alcohol. So they found this brand of rap music that is a perfect mate with those messages. And they started placing the product in the actual videos, and everything's always happening in the club, and everybody's young and hedonistic and doesn't care about tomorrow, and that's who they want to sell all this alcohol to, and they do it back to the
And if I can add on, this is Fat Fish speaking, if I can add on, the system, the industry, it's an instrument, it's a machine. It doesn't respect the integrity of the culture of hip-hop, of the music, or the artist. You know, that's not what it was built for. And it turns it into something else, a commercial, just like Jeff was saying, you know, to sell the product, record companies affiliating themselves with private prison industry as well, right? So you're selling poison and you're selling death. You're selling incarceration, you're selling bodies. The machine doesn't care about art. From an industry standpoint, they're not in the business of preserving culture and integrity.
Young people are highly impressionable. To be frank, a lot of the music out here is very, very dangerous as far as its message. So who does the onus fall upon? Does it fall upon the label to release it, the artist who makes it, or the listener who consumes it?
I can speak to that if you're talking about kids. The music creates an environment. It creates a climate, and it creates a thought pattern. It creates ideas, beliefs. You know, I can tell you for sure, as a teacher, as a high school teacher, music absolutely has an impact on my students. And again, we're talking about high school people from 14 to 17, 18 years old, right? And if they're listening to toxic music, not 100% of the time, right, but often, that's going to have an impact on them and really mold how they view the world. And I see it every day because, unfortunately, and again, this is just my experience. It's not a general statement for all kids throughout the world. But in my experience, I know that there's a definite link. It's undeniable. When students are really heavy into, I just call it toxic, right? For the lack of one, right? I just call it toxic. Where they're into toxic music, that shows up in their everyday decisions. You know?
I want some examples. What are some examples of these toxic rappers and rap songs?
Well, you know,
I'm curious.
You know, I'm 48, right? So what's toxic to me? You know what I mean? It's not
right.
It's not going to be toxic to this 15 or 16 year old.
Exactly.
That has a different worldview. You know, but I can tell you,
6ix9ine is toxic. 6ix9ine is toxic. 6ix9ine is toxic.
Obviously, yes.
Right.
Well, 6ix9ine is absolutely toxic.
Right.
So Extentation is toxic.
Exactly. So when I have conversations with my students, you know, they'll tell me how things that we consider toxic, and again, it's nothing new, right? Whether it's misogyny, rape, artists getting in trouble or locked up, a lot of my students don't really see a problem with that. It's been normalized. Depression has been normalized. Whether, you know, we look at artists like XXX, it ends up being a thing of like, oh, I can self-medicate too because I don't feel good. Could that be true? Are there real mental health problems at work? Of course there are. But it creates an atmosphere, it creates a climate where everything that is unhealthy, toxic, poisonous, dysfunctional becomes the norm and it becomes okay. And people make billions of dollars off creating that image.
With that being said, to answer Khalil's question, the responsibility is on the label, the artist, and the listener. It's on all three. The label and the artist are overall responsible for what's coming out. But the listener empowers the label and the artist. It's hard to listen to conscious music these days because no one wants to hear it. Like you said, Seb, ignorance. Everyone else likes it, so yeah, it's acceptable. It's sad. It's a herd mentality.
Yeah, it's that group.
I was going to say, I think that a lot of times when we see these things, it's a reflection of where the society is. So if the society is in a general deeper state of dissatisfaction in life, that probably is going to end up being reflected in the music of the younger people.
For instance, the gentleman's name that overdosed not that long ago, Juice WRLD.
If you listen to what connected him with young people, he's literally expressing the frustrations of, man, it ain't no future worth worrying about, of the people of his age range and what the approach is to dealing with. And so I think that it's hard to have an people in that age range to have positive, uplifting music if the world they're looking forward to doesn't bring that.
I also like to bring up the point too, you know, I've been watching a lot of older producers and interviewers. I watched the interview with Wyclef Jean, I watched the interview with Comet and Ice Cube, and like a lot of them talking about being older and looking at how they were when they were younger and the decisions that they would or would not make, right? So the music that we were listening to, people our age now, then, were saying that it was toxic. Perhaps it was, right? But we didn't all end up drug addicts and suicided and all that stuff. And, you know, looking at things in time and perspective, what's toxic then and what's toxic now? And, right. And you know, it's toxic to a particular mind, right? When you're listening to it now, you could be like, oh, okay, he said some wild shit, but I can handle it. I know the context. I know what he's talking about. I know some of the history, right? When you're young, perhaps that context isn't there.
Everybody's making points. And I think that if we can all respect that we are connected in some way to the process of making the thing that's being consumed by others, right? We have a different point of view. One thing that we do know is what we're doing is a very, very powerful art form. And for impressionable minds, it can put them in a space or in a thought process to do things maybe they wouldn't have without the suggestion. But again, it's how suggestible is your mind. We tend to be less suggestible minds. That's where it gets tricky in terms of the responsibility of the artist in it, because people will stand behind things like, you know, I only make music for myself, or I have the First Amendment, or I have the freedom of expression because it's art, and I should be able to do what I want. But at the end of the day, if it is very powerful programming, there's responsibility that comes with the power. I think that can't be overlooked by the artist, because the companies are going to exploit whatever kind of widget they can make money. They don't respect art. Art and business going together is kind of like an unholy union to start with, where people need to pay the rent, right? I think that there is a bigger responsibility in the artist's hands, because we are spiritually vibrant enough to make music, to understand we bring something from another place to here. That's not something that people that go punch the clock necessarily understand. So maybe we have a little more responsibility to think about what it is that we're releasing into the world as representing our name.
I love that point, because it depends on if you're going to be an artist, if you're going to be that channel, and then also if you're going to be a capitalist. Are you an artist, or are you an artist capitalist, right? Because if you're an artist, you want to inspire other people to do something similar, if not what you're doing, right? If you're an artist capitalist, you can't inspire them, because then they're going to make better music than you, and now you're out of a job. So it's like, you gotta, this is that fine line. Like,
one of the Hemingway kids, the Hemingway family of actors, I don't remember her name, but she wrote this pretty well-known book called The Artist's Way. It's more well-known on the actor side, but like in your head, in the headspace. And one of the things she talks about in the book is the difference between a true artist, what they call a hack. A hack is the person that can look at the diagram after somebody figured it out, like how to start, how to blow up, how to make it go for 5 years, how to get the right endorsements along the way, and they'll follow that path, and they'll come in the hundreds. You know what I mean? Like, because that's just how much it's just about the money. Money.
I be liking that dumb too. I love it. I love it. Y'all.
We have the second half of this conversation later in the show. My next guest is Dr. Nicole Nelson, who published a piece in the Washington Post titled Reparations Need to Be a Part of the Conversation About Racial Justice. Dr. Nelson, thanks for being with me.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, of course. I'm really excited to have this talk because, you know, the conversation about reparations to the Black community has been going on for quite a while. Over the years, it kind of ebbs and flows into the dialogue about racial justice. Give us a little bit of history on reparations in the United States.
We really see the first push for reparations, funny enough, with slave masters in Washington, D.C., where they were compensated for having their slaves freed during the Civil War. Each of them received about $300 per slave. But even after that, when African Americans who were formerly enslaved began to push for reparations, you saw that first with Callie House, who was a formerly enslaved woman. Well, she was formerly enslaved as a child, and she created the Ex-Slave Mutual Relief Bounty and Pension Association in 1898, and she petitioned Congress for pensions for formerly enslaved African Americans. Unfortunately, Congress never responded in kind to those petitions, and unfortunately, she was set up on trumped-up charges of mail fraud in 1916 for having done some fundraising on different members' behalf and just trying to kind of help out African Americans after the Civil War the best way that she could and into the 20th century. There had been different movements to push H.R. 40 through Congress that were unsuccessful in every congressional session from 1989 through 2017. And recently, Representative Sheila Jackson Lee sponsored a new iteration of the bill, and that kind of picked up steam last session with the hearing on it. Really, in light of George Floyd's murder, we're having a renewed conversation about reparations, I believe, because the protests are not just about his murder, though that was the immediate cause. They're also about the longstanding causes of inequality in the Black community and how that's impacted African Americans through the deprivation of wealth and the deprivation of opportunities over time and how that's accumulated. And really, the rebellions are just a scream of frustration, pain, and anger. We need lasting change if we really want to make sure that all Americans are equal.
What have been some of the roadblocks to having any serious dialogues about reparations?
So some white Americans might feel that, why is it that I should pay for something my ancestors did however many hundreds of years ago? Or they might say, oh, my family didn't come over to the United States until after the Civil War. Why is it that I should pay? Other things include the myth of how would we decide who would qualify for reparations, which it's much easier than people think too, considering most Black people in the United States would qualify. So I don't understand that logic or that thinking. It's unfortunate, but I think that given that other ethnic groups have received reparations in the United States, I really think it speaks to A, a lack of political will, and B, unfortunately, anti-Black racism, that people just say, oh, slavery, it happened, Jim Crow, and other subsequent systems that happened, you know, to African Americans, get over it. But African Americans are still living with the effects of that, so we can't just get over it.
And, you know, last year, the House hosted that hearing about H.R. 40, that bill to enact a commission to the study of reparations. And in response, they talked to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and he said, I quote, "I don't think reparations for something that happened 150 years ago, for whom none of us currently living are responsible, is a good idea." He also went on to say, "We've tried to deal with our original sin of slavery by fighting a civil war, by passing landmark civil rights legislation. We elected an African-American president." That's at the end of his comments. You know, but why is this claim of civil rights legislation and the election of Barack Obama often used as this sort of, look, now we're even type of play?
Right. It's weird to me that it's used as now we're even. I'm looking at the civil rights legislation, for instance, and what sticks out immediately is the Voting Rights Act and how there's been attacks on the Voting Rights Act. And now there's all types of voter suppression, trying to limit the ability of people of color, especially Black people, especially African Americans, to vote. So the now we're equal shtick doesn't really hold up. With the Fair Housing Act, that's another piece of civil rights legislation that really hasn't had the enforcement measures to really like tackle housing discrimination the way it's been needed to. Though yes, it prevents overt discrimination, it doesn't prevent more subtle forms of housing discrimination like realtor steering. And the idea of all of these things as reparations, well, they're reparative policies, right? So reparations are different from reparative policies. So reparations, usually it's the idea of some sort of cash payment or reinvestment in communities harmed for a particular wrong. and reparations for slavery are separate from reparative policies. It brings me to the idea that we'll probably need multiple forms of reparative policies, both reparations and reparative policies, and kind of getting away from the idea, I know that the Supreme Court loves to have with affirmative action, look, you know, affirmative action, you know, it was working, so now we can take it away. Well, no, the system as it stands tends to be a white supremacist one, so we need to kind of account for that and just never say, look, we're equal, when it's been embedded in the system, this form of inequality.
Do you see something like, in these multi-tiered format, do you see something like, you know, reparations as far as some type of financial reparations, and maybe something like the reconciliation courts that took place after apartheid ended in South Africa?
So I pause because I just admire the fact that that happened in South Africa the way it did. I pause because that would really take a national moment where politicians, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republicans, the House Republicans, even some Democrats in particular, like conservative blue states or even purple states, to really take a long, hard look in the mirror. I want to be hopeful that that could happen.
Yeah.
Something tells me we might be a few years away from that happening, or at least a few months away from that happening. People really admitting, like politicians really admitting, this is how my family continued to benefit from slavery, even though, you know, I did not personally own slaves.
Yeah. The conversation about reparations, the actual dollar amount, is really hard to grapple with. You know, it's going to be a really high amount. How do you quantify it with the horrors of slavery? What do you think any dollar amount should really be based on? Should it be based on the 40 acres and a mule that was promised and rescinded by Andrew Jackson?
It could be based on a couple of things. It could be based on the 40 acres and a mule. It could be based on the value of slaves in about 1860 that historian Stephen Dale estimates. It could be based on the output that those slaves produced plus their value at the time. It could be based on a number of things. And something tells me that it could be estimated in the trillions.
And that might scare Congress from acting. And that leads me to, how would it go? What's stronger? Is a court decision enacting reparations stronger than Congress enacting something?
That's tough, because when I think back to, for instance, even though this is a different context and shorter period of time, when Japanese Americans, when they received reparations for being interned, that was a smaller population, and that was for a number of years. With the way things are going politically, and I really cross my fingers when I say this, hopefully Joe Biden is the next president and President Trump is a one-term president, and maybe also if Congress flips, maybe that would hold, because I'm also thinking about the number of Republicans who control the courts, even with the Supreme Court being majority, like, right-leaning. It probably would have to come through Congress or some sort of executive order or something like that.
You know, here in Albuquerque, the city started a Black community investment fund. And some of the arguments against it, that maybe Black people here won't be able to handle or manage all that money. We've even, in fact, had a city councilor compare it to handing $1 million to children, which they're definitely going to hear more about that. Are those racist arguments used against reparations as well?
Yes, I've never heard of any other group being compared to children like that. I'm thinking about the history of the vilification of African-American spending habits going back to Reagan and the stereotype about welfare queens. And it really has a despicable, problematic history. I really wish there could be a litmus test for lawmakers so that anyone who held those views would be deemed inappropriate to hold office.
You know, we live in these systems that refuse to acknowledge their racism. It's been a blueprint and a guidance to citizens who refuse to acknowledge their racism. So I'm asking, is there ever a time to stop waiting for them to change, to do a thing like offer reparations, you know? And in that case, what would we do instead? Rather than wait for these systems to suddenly become enlightened, what can we do instead?
I wonder what it would look like if either A, we somehow decided to vote all those politicians who held those particular views out of office. B, somehow, I think back to the history after the Civil War during Reconstruction, where there were all Black towns, if that could also require disinvestment from certain power structures, having all black towns, having all black businesses, which there are many, but really just putting our dollars into our own communities, mm-hmm. and really just enriching ourselves that way while we wait for reparations in the meantime.
Yeah. I hear you. She's Dr. Nicole Nelson. She published a piece in the Washington Post titled Reparations Need to Be a Part of the Conversation About Racial Justice. Thank you so much for being with me. Please come on the show again.
Thank you. Will do.
The city of Albuquerque recently decided to allocate $1 million to a brand new Black community investment fund. It's a part of the One Albuquerque Foundation. I talked with the person in charge of figuring out what to do next. I'm joined by Charles Ashley III. He is an entrepreneur and a problem solver. Talk to me about the Black Community Investment Fund. What is it? How does it work? And how is that a part of the One Albuquerque?
Considering the landscape of Albuquerque and New Mexico, when people talk about this place, they always say tricultural, tricultural, tricultural. Mm-hmm. And I've been out here 13 years now, and it's been very evident that our Black community has been ignored. Mm-hmm. Like, you can see it from the fact that we've had three or four iterations of a Black chamber, which now the chamber that is up, that's ran by Teresa Carson, is doing a phenomenal job. And I'm proud to see what we're building with that, right? Yeah. But then if you look at when people talk about programs or whatnot, it'll say earmarked for Native communities, it'll say earmarked for Hispanic communities, it'll say earmarked for this community. You rarely hear it's earmarked for Black community, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. Usually, if that happens, someone or some group will come in and say, well, what about the Hispanic kids? Or what about the Native kid? Right. So instead of it just being, hey, let's just admit that Black folks out here, we live here, but we're not really recognized. Like, if we're honest about it, then you can address it.
Yeah.
So with that Black Investment Fund, in conjunction with some people in the city, in conjunction with some other people, we're very adamant, like, hey, we should try to get some money and earmark it for the Black community.
Okay.
Well, we as the city decided we're just not going to give it to you. It has to go to council. So went to city council. We bit our tongue on a lot of the stuff that was being said, in, like in regards to, well, what are you going to do with the money? And we were very clear. Well, since we've never had anything in a community, we will go and we will work with the community, the Black community, and decide what we want to do with the money. Councilwoman Jones, in particular, in Borrego, kept harping on, well, what are you going to do with the money? Instead of accepting the answer of, we don't know what to do with the money because we've never had anything out here. So we're going to go and research and talk to the community, and the community is going to determine what we're going to do with the money. But just like every other group that comes before the council or gets funding from the city, there's deliverables. So before they even would give us the money, we would outline deliverables, measurables, right?
Yeah.
So there was already like oversight. The council, Jones and Borrego, wanted more oversight.
Did they explain why they wanted more oversight?
Because they said it's like loaning your child money.
Whoa, they said that.
Yes. So I bit my tongue on that. And I was in there with Ken Carson, and for your viewers or listeners who don't know Ken Carson.
Oh, they know Ken. He's been on the show several times.
Exactly. One of the most prominent and established business people in New Mexico. And then Lauren Ruffin, who she's a lawyer, very established, CEO of her company called Fracture Allen, which is a global company based out of, I believe, New York. So you have these people who are accomplished, who know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And for the council to not even know who they're speaking to and speaking to us that way was so disrespectful. Yet we knew what we were in there for. It was like eyes on a prize. Let's just get the vote, get the money, and we're going to show you what we're going to do with the money. The issue with that was loaning the child money, which was disrespectful. The paternalism, right? Instead of just giving you money, we should teach you guys how to run businesses.
Ah.
That was said. I've always been pretty outspoken already, but that just lit another fire under me. Mm-hmm. Where it was, these are the people we're voting in our city, and they have thoughts like that. We're never going to get anywhere.
Yeah.
We got the money. And the reason why we earmarked a Black Investment Fund is for that reason. We're in a process where we're bringing on a community process coordinator, which is going to help the fund build out the process into what it would look like to engage the Black community, to have the Black community at the table, to have the Black community leading us. And we're doing it in a thoughtful way. When you think about how most things are started, it's without any input from the communities that is supposed to help.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And it's probably going to be a long process, but it's going to be built the most thoughtful way.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
That's the goal of it.
Okay.
So right now I couldn't tell you what the community is going to invest in, but my personal thoughts on things would be, I'm hoping that we create something that we're going to leverage that funds and bring in more resources.
Gotcha.
And not just spend the money, right?
Yeah.
And not just focus on programs and not just focus on backpack drives or food drives, which are all great things. I would want to leverage it where we bring in more funding, where we can create something that's more structural, that is going to be sustainable and it continues to fund all of those things that we need in our community. Instead of just being a funded program, mm-hmm. it'd be great to have something that is the funding source.
Obviously, the Black community is going to have a certain level of buy-in, but it sounds to me like from the comments that two city councilors made, the rest of the city and the state of New Mexico and this tricultural menage that we're all in is going to have to understand and buy into this as well so we can have that support. Have you all come up with ideas of how to create that?
Not yet. And that's why we're leaning on what the process is going to be like, right? And leaning on what different groups are going to tell us. Because if we can get all of that together, and yeah, it's going to be noisy in the beginning because, you know, there's so many different voices and whatnot. But that's the importance of building like a process that's going to allow everyone to have a voice, that's going to allow everything to be heard, that's going to allow us to collaborate and create something that we will present. And let's be real, man, we're not presenting this to the white people. This is us presenting this to us. The tone that the councilwoman had, that's enough fuel to anyone's fire to say, we are not pandering to you.
Yeah.
This is for our community. We'll create something for us. Hopefully, you'll respect us enough to jump on board. But if not, then we'll just have to proceed without you.
Where can the audience and the listeners go to find out this information and find out more for themselves?
You can go to onealbuquerque.org. We encourage people to attend the meetings, in particular to the Black Investment Fund. We encourage people, if you're private donors, look at the things that we're supporting through our fund. And if you're interested, to donate to it. This is something that we can lean on well beyond Tim.
Yeah.
Well beyond whoever's next. This is something where we can say there's things in this community that we want to invest in, and we don't want to have to take it to people at council.
Yeah, yeah. Something that's lasting, that's permanent, and that is fully in the community's control. I want to thank you very much again for joining me. It's Charles Ashley III. He's with One Albuquerque, the Black Community Investment Fund. He's an entrepreneur and problem solver. Thanks for joining me on Nomono, Charles.
Hello, my man. Appreciate your time.
Next, Ademola Ekolona, my father, talks to me about self-determination. And yes, our conversations are pretty much always like this. Just to ask my siblings.
I got involved in the civil rights movement back in the 1950s, 54, right after Emmett Till got killed. And I've been involved ever since. I know that in the African-American community that there are different roads that you could go down. My parents let it be very clear to me early, very early in my life. I think I was 10, 12 years old. My mother and my aunt sat down. I was eating this spaghetti. My aunt Kay made this wonderful spaghetti. I was chowing down on that spaghetti, and they was talking to me. Yeah, but you know, men in our family don't go to jail. And they both looked at me with that look that the mama could give you. I'm trying to eat, and they making me feel very awkward. And they had to let me know that that was not expected of me. And I had to cool my behaviors. Whatever I was going to do, I was not to be arrested by the police. And that's what I mean about self-determination. That when African people in America decide that self-determination is required and necessary and even possible, then they're going to have the reparations. I see right now that certainly you, if you have decided that you was going to be a marginalized do nothing, you better make sure I'm in the grave. You understand?
Yeah.
Because I'm not accepting nothing like that at all. My parents made it clear to me that you are never an end, ever. And if you decide to act like that, don't come in this house. Right.
Between you and Ia. Yeah, no, I knew I wouldn't survive the night.
That's right, that's right. I'm working on some pieces now to do some advice things for young men, young urban men, because I'm seeing young men who have, you can tell that they had a good early childhood education because they got the fundamental basic skills, but they hide the ability to use them because we have an overall male culture in the community that says education, you know, is good if you get it, but f*** it if you don't.
Mm.
And you can't have that and still be competitive.
See, I say, okay, Black Lives Matter. Immediately when I heard it, I said, well, black people, you got to prove it. If they matter, then why is JoJo shooting Buck? At 15, 19, 18, 20, 22, you are not fully developed in the brain. You should not put yourself in a position where you think, you know, I ain't afraid to die. I asked some young men that 19, 20 years old, a few years ago. I asked them, you afraid to die? And there's three of them in the car. No, no, no. One of them said, I'm afraid to live. Last month or something, there was a baby that was shot with a bullet in the car because someone was after them for the baby's father. Well, under that circumstance, how can anyone in the black community justify the don't snitch principle? This baby is shot with a bullet. Someone's finger pulled that trigger. In Baltimore City, the police estimate there might be 4 or 5% of the population that's engaging in all this gun violence. And so that means there's probably at least 90% of this population that's not doing it. Mm-hmm. What we have to do is say, okay, well, if this 90% has to deal with this systemic racism and they are not shooting one another, what about the personal responsibility factor in that 5%? But I'm saying for black people, if Black Lives Matter, we got to be the ones to prove it. I think it's a response to the COVID restrictions, why there's been such increase in gun violence in all these different cities.
Yeah.
Especially because male behavior is something that this country got to contend with. I had to learn something because I was nationalist back in the 60s and 70s and was basically a guide to how to put Marxism in blackface. But I came to understand that true African culture is very different. Did not need Marx, didn't need Jefferson either. So I have to infuse in the younger generation, let us define the self-determination based upon the experiences that we have had to get it. Black people have to understand that our humanity was rejected during slavery. They used our human capacities and energy, but they would not allow the human to develop. And they created conditions under which if you attempted to develop beyond your physical capacity so that, you know, you could actually accomplish the task that the master gave you, if it looked like you were trying to do something beyond that, you were severely punished. Your tongue could be cut or your ear taken. We have to realize that that's what happened. I know from dealing with people who had the tattoos from the concentration camp on their arm, I know that that happened. And the Jewish people are never going to forget it. And I know that most African people do not have the tattoos, but they need to understand it's in our epigenetics, it's in our behavior. When the young man will give up before fully trying, he has surrendered to that slave mentality. We gotta develop ourselves, and not so that somebody could decide we're worth it, but so that we make it inevitable that we get what we need.
Today, we are looking at some of the journey toward racial equality and justice. I had so many amazing conversations with people this week, and they wouldn't all fit into the hour. The online version of this show is going to include the extended cuts. Find No More Normal at KUNM.org or wherever you get your podcasts. In the next half hour, we hear from a national security expert, and we learn about Black August, a month of training and studying in the honor of Black revolutionaries. Stick around. Protests for racial justice across the country and globe have brought out tens of thousands of people all calling for change. KUNM's Nash Jones brings us a story of a protest of one.
Every weekday for a month, Elizabeth Ward stood and sometimes sat with a Black Lives Matter sign on a dusty street corner in her sprawling Albuquerque suburb. Ward is a 67-year-old Black resident of Rio Rancho, a city that's on average whiter and more conservative than Albuquerque, with an all-Republican governing body, including the mayor and six-seat city council. While it's the fastest-growing city in the state, large swaths of it remain undeveloped desert land that butts up against the newer home developments and national chain stores. The corner Ward held her sign on was a small dirt lot on an otherwise developed street lined with homes a few minutes from her house.
It leads down to the county courthouse, and it also leads to the Sandoval County offices. And so I decided to come either 5 to 6 or 8 to 9 to catch the people going to work or coming home from work. And this spot has really good parking.
In addition to being down the road from the county courthouse, her protests were across the street from a house flying MAGA country and Blue Lives Matter flags, surrounded by a wall with several Trump 2020 signs. It was seeing this yard in her neighborhood that first put the idea in Ward's mind.
I was driving down this road and I saw all of his signs and I thought, you know, Rio Rancho needs a wake-up call.
While protests against racial injustice and police brutality had erupted across the country and in nearby Albuquerque, she hadn't seen any actions in her sprawling, more right-wing suburb.
I just felt like in Rio Rancho, I know it's conservative, but nothing was happening. It was like people were walking around pretending that the nation wasn't under strife.
There have been a few Rio Rancho demonstrations, but they weren't hugely visible. A group of about 100 gathered in front of City Hall in early June. Albuquerque activist Arthur Bell spoke at that event.
Looking at these numbers, we have a lot of work to do in Rio Rancho.
It wasn't only her neighbor's flags or the seeming inaction of her community that inspired Ward to act. It was also her relationship with a woman whose son, a black man with mental health challenges, had been shot and killed by police in Michigan in 2012.
I met her playing cards at the Senior Citizen Center. So she's like my friend. And so we were just kind of talking. And then she was telling me about her son. And I thought, okay, Black Lives Matter. I need to get out here and do something. She's 88, so she can't stand out here. And so that was the main reason. And I think my longevity was because I know someone personally whose son was murdered by law enforcement.
Looking around at what actions she could get involved in, the large demonstrations happening in neighboring Albuquerque didn't feel accessible.
I was uncomfortable when I was seeing people on TV, no masks, and I thought, I'm in a high-risk situation. I'm not going down there to be exposed to COVID.
While not all protesters wear masks, and some might remove them to speak on TV, KUNM has noted the majority of racial justice protesters in Albuquerque have been masked up. Some organizers have even fundraised to provide PPE to demonstrators. Regardless, attending a large demonstration poses a COVID risk, so Ward came up with her own plan. She'd put on a mask and head down to the dirt lot across from the Trump signs Monday through Friday to let the daily commuters know that Black Lives Matter. And she wasn't protesting solo for long.
I would say like the third day, they looked like they were in their 20s, two girls, and they said that their father drove by and said, there's this little old lady out there with her sign. You need to go out there and help her.
Then more joined, other passersby, people who worked with her husband, and some of her sorority sisters, women she'd connected with in New Mexico, though she went to the University of Maryland, College Park. There she joined Zeta Phi Beta, an historically black sorority founded in 1920 at Howard University. She arrived at the interview wearing her Zeta t-shirt.
I was in college in the early 70s, and I've always been like an activist protesting and stuff. But part of my sorority is to get involved, do final work, to also be able to support our community and to stand up for social action and social justice.
Ward says her daily street corner protests got to be about 10 to 15 people deep in all. And the new recruits hung in there even as the across-the-way neighbor began counter-protesting a few yards away on the same corner.
He was here every day that I was here. He would beat me out there because he had so many flags. We figured it took him an hour and a half to put up all those flags. So he would be there and I would be here. We kind of went, okay, we can coexist. You have your say, I have my say.
At the end of the second week, a group of about 30 counter-protesters showed up to support the neighbor with flags, signs, trucks, and motorcycles. Some were armed, which dissuaded most of Ward's supporters from continuing to come out.
When the folks showed up with the rifles, that was kind of scary. So after that day, then it was just me and one other person.
Ward gave the group of counter-protesters some space and says they never interacted directly.
I ceded the corner. I just said, you know what, y'all want to have it, you can have the corner.
The Rio Rancho police began to patrol the protests, too.
The first time when they came, they said, well, we got a call. We're here to make sure you're safe. They did, and they stayed, and then my hour was up. I packed up my stuff, and we left.
According to notes taken by Ward's husband, the police checked in on the protests on 8 separate occasions. Her last standing supporter, a sorority sister, eventually stopped coming too. For the last 2 weeks, it was just her and her husband, Bill. They ended their month-long action on July 24th, and not because of the counter-protesters, but
because I was getting more people that were give me thumbs up. People were stopping, handing me water. In the morning, they give me coffee. So I felt like I got my point across. I'm out here. You know that you didn't run me away, and I'm still saying Black Lives Matter.
While her street-side sign-waving days are over for now, Ward says that she may be back out to protest Operation Legend, a program that's deployed federal agents to Albuquerque.
Just kind of waiting to see what happens, and if it gets bad, I'll be down here. My husband said, oh, Lord, we're going to be driving down to Albuquerque so she can be protesting down there.
Ward says long-term, achieving social and racial equity in the U.S. will rely on a cultural shift that comes from asking tough questions and having what she calls courageous conversations.
There are all kinds of things and laws that are in place that prevent people from being successful. So it's kind of, you have to change your institutions, and that isn't going to happen until the mindset of folks change.
For No More Normal and KUNM News, I'm Nash Jones in Rio Rancho.
On the road to equality, there are plenty of hazards. The Federal Protective Service at protests, social media hacks, foreign actors, and the security of November's general election. These are just a few of the challenges we face to our civil liberties and our national security. I turn to Richard A. Clark, who spent 30 years as a senior national policy advisor and who served under three presidents. Since President Trump announced Operation Legend, we've seen very questionable tactics used by FPS security forces in Portland. This has led to a mistrust and a growing skepticism as to the legality of these methods and the role of the Department of Homeland Security. Can you just explain the DHS and how it fits into all of this?
Well, DHS is a monster agency. It's huge. It was made in 2003 by taking 17 different agencies and putting them all together. So, and now it's about 18 agencies, I think. And many of them are police agencies in the sense that members of the agencies have police power and they have badges, they have guns, they have arrest authority under certain federal laws. They can enforce certain federal laws. And one of these agencies that no one's ever heard of is something called the Federal Protective Service, FPS. And they have a very narrow little job. They protect federal buildings. They used to protect them themselves, but now mainly they supervise rent-a-cops, private security guards. And it is this force that's in charge of the federal building security in Portland. And what apparently has happened is the FPS in Portland said, well, there are threats to our building. We are not big enough to defend the building. Therefore, we are invoking a procedure that allows any agency in DHS to call for help from any other agency. So they called for help, and apparently DHS responded by sending this sort of bizarre SWAT team that they've created within the Border Patrol. So why the Border Patrol needs a team that looks like it's ready for the apocalypse, I don't know, but they have one. And I think that's the group that they sent up, along with other agents from other federal divisions within DHS. These people were not trained for riot control and not trained for crowd control, and apparently not even trained for arrest procedures, because they were snatching people off the streets without giving them their Miranda rights, without telling them what they were accused of, even without identifying themselves as police, you know, because these guys look almost identical to some of the right-wing militias that are roaming around Oregon.
You know, a lot of organizers, activists, and journalists say that they're being surveilled and followed by government forces and police. Is surveillance of journalists in particular, is that legal?
No, not without a predicate. And under the Attorney General guidelines, no one can be surveilled without there being probable cause of a crime. They can't just decide, now, Dick Clark is a pain in the ass, doesn't like the president, I want to open an investigation on him and see what we can find. You can't do that.
You know, I see this because we see these same type of actions in authoritarian governments across the globe, where they vilify the press initially, then they begin attacking the press at protests. That's raising a lot of concern. What type of protections do people who are being surveilled unjustly have?
Well, if they can prove to a federal court that they are being surveilled, they can ask a federal court for an order stopping it. If they do that, you know, they need a lawyer and they need to spend some money. But if they do that, then the federal judge can say to the U.S. government, show cause why you have a right to surveil that person. Mm. Show cause. Frequently at that point, they'll back off and they'll enter into a written agreement that they won't do it anymore. But you shouldn't have to go to a court. You shouldn't have to have a lawyer to protect your own basic rights. The government should be protecting your rights, not infringing on them.
Yeah.
And what you just said, I think, is absolutely right. The U.S. government under Trump is taking all of the steps that authoritarian regimes have taken all across the world. It's a playbook that goes step by step. The first step is discredit the media. Tell people that the media are the enemy of the state, which are the exact words that Trump used. Mm-hmm. You discredit the media, and then you take over the police. Mm-hmm. And you, bit by bit, you corrupt and overtake control of the government. That's exactly what he's doing, and it's exactly what every dictator has ever done.
President Trump is deploying federal forces to Democratic-led states. We mentioned that. But he's saying that he may not step down if he loses the November election. Does this pose a threat to national security? And what can be done about that?
Well, ultimately, there's going to be an Electoral College meeting. And if the Electoral College gives 270 votes to Joe Biden, then Trump is no longer president, no matter what he says and no matter what he does. And I think the instruments of government will respect that. I think the real threat is if the Electoral College doesn't get to 270, if Trump challenges various states. And if he does that and the Electoral College meets and some states don't vote, you know, because they're still wrapped up in trying to decide who won, if no one gets to 270, then it goes to the House. And there's a little known procedure in the Constitution. The House decides by voting one state at a time. So take California, 45 congressmen, women. Those 45 congressmen and women get together and they vote, and California gets one vote. So we know that the majority of them would be Democrats, and therefore California would vote for Biden. But if you look at each of the 50 states, probably most of them have a Republican caucus. There are more Republican members of the House in some of these states than there are Democrats, because the Democratic Congress people tend to be concentrated in states like New York, California. If you did that vote today, I bet of the 50 states, more than 25 would be Republican. It could be, therefore, if no one wins the Electoral College because no one gets to a majority, you could see the House of Representatives voting in this one vote, one state kind of way, reelecting Trump.
He's Richard Clark, author, analyst, and spent 30 years in national security policy roles in the Pentagon and the State Department. Thanks so much for being on the show, Wolf.
Great to be with you.
Here's part two of our discussion, Hip Hop, the COVID-19 remix, with A. Billy Free, Awad Bilal, Jeff Jadstone Alberson, Sebastian Seb Eckelby, and Roscoe Flo Fader Floyd.
I be liking that dumb shit, too. I love it. I love it.
What about songs like Bachiana? I mean, according to the street definition, that word is a pejorative directed towards women. Yet a lot of women love the song. Explain that. I don't get it.
I mean, I kind of get it.
Because I can
get it.
I get it. Let me tell you what black people are amazing at. We're amazing at language, if nothing else. Never forget, this entire art form is language. And having fun with it and using it to express yourself in different ways and like stretch exactly like where you're at, like where your headspace is at. Like when you're in the studio that day doing whatever it is, this is where you are. And that man literally went in that studio and said, bust down body
on it. It's an anthem. It's an anthem. That's why.
I felt it. And let me tell you, everything became Puppiana, Plantiana, everything was an Iana. Just for that whole like two, three weeks. How beautiful are we? That's black as f. I love it. It's so good.
I mean, I don't mind this song. I just wish that it was done by a woman. You know, I feel like a lot of these tracks
might even be ghostwritten by women, who knows? But, you know, there's this whole, like, feminism movement and womanist movement and empowering women. Why? Because the quote-unquote patriarchy, the quote-unquote oppression, right? And so now you have a rebellion, you have a resistance of women saying, look, this is my body, I'm gonna do whatever I want with it, and as much as you've oppressed me, I'm gonna go the other way, you know what I mean? And there's a sense of power inside of that. I get it, I do get it, and I get melanin is viral. Pretty much anything that we do is gonna be dope, you know what I mean?
Let's talk about some of your experiences in the music industry. Have any of you ever run into, you know, racist situations while you're making music and pursuing your careers?
All right, so this is when I used to rhyme still. So this is around 1994, me and my group, we, you know, conscious hip hop. You know, we grew up on P.E., we grew up on, you know, DDP, Rakim. So by 94, we are well on our way to having defined our sound. We were very close to signing a deal. As a matter of fact, the day of signing the contract, which is 3 months after going through negotiations with our manager, attorneys, et cetera, the day of signing, based on the music, on the demos, on the music that they had heard, they said that the first album is gonna have to be gangster rap. And I'm like, that's not what we do. Not at all, not even close to it. But they say, yeah, you know, it's just the first album. Second album, you can do what you want. But first album, you want to focus on this whole gangster rap thing? I mean, you know, it's 1994. This is, you know, Snoop and Dre and, you know, all of that. That's the direction they wanted us to go into. You know, and when I said, no, I'm not signing, I mean, it caused chaos at the label, but they were shocked that somebody would actually say no. Howard, no, or no, no. You know, you got to think, how many people took the bait? You know, whether this label or another label, how many people said, like, okay, I'll do it. Now, I was broke as hell at the time. It wasn't worth, you know, my soul or my integrity or anything, so I didn't do it. But it's prevalent. It happened to me.
And you didn't go into debt either by trying to pay back that debt.
That's right. Absolutely.
My personal experiences, I've had issues with a venue downtown that's hired me because of my followers. But then when I got didn't want to play music that my followers wanted to listen to. My following's black, and they wanted me to play more EDM-type music. I have a following, they hired me, but they wanted me to change my format to accommodate the club. I felt some type of way at the end of the night, man. I felt some type of way. I say professional, I did my job. But at the end of the night, I felt like I got jerked. I felt I couldn't be me. I couldn't express myself. And my following that came to support me was upset because this white manager tried to manage me and tell me how to manage the mess. Called him a asshole at the end of the night. But I couldn't keep it to myself. I couldn't keep that inside. I had to express it. I had to let him know how I felt, and I was fired because of it. But okay, sarah, sarah, I continue on.
Strong. You know, for me, working with labels, it's been like a journey. Like, I'm inherently independent, but I'm like, okay, I don't have no experience when I first started out. Let me go ahead and do a collaboration with a label. And then within that, you know, there's all of the, like, weird, passive aggressive, kind of racist emails, kind of sexist emails, you know what I mean? That's where some of that seeps into. For me, it's just been a part of the journey, learning how to collaborate and then also build my integrity for, you know, maximum independence.
Here we are in 2020, and it's the COVID-19 remix, and that puts a different spin on the future. So what do you see the future for yourselves, for music? What would you like?
I'm actually building my future to kind of transition away from the music industry. Our world is definitely going to turn into something different. And if I can be ahead of the curve and be doing something different as opposed to music, because I'm not sure if my career is going to be relevant and tangible anymore, society is definitely going to change. I'm a people person. I do miss seeing people and embracing people. So that's something that's going to stop. A lot of hip hop has to do with handstands and hugs and just showing love and embracing each other, you know? And that's definitely out the window right now.
I think a part of what's happening is to localize and cleanse locally so that when you do come back into contact with people like what we're doing now, you've purified your own energy so we can magnify that. I think that's a part of what the isolation is about, is each one teach one, but also taking time to spiritually cleanse and see what's going on and be willing to face yourself. That's what the time is forcing. Like maybe month two, you think you know it and you got it all together and everything. And then you have a good third month and you lose the COVID weight and you stop drinking. But then in the fourth month, you pick the bottle back up, you're learning something about yourself. Maybe if you were super busy, you could have avoided all that and not seen it. One of the things I've noticed is, and all this happened post George Floyd, there's a lot of frenetic passion and energy, but it doesn't seem to be homogenized. There's a thousand voices screaming something slightly different. And that's what made me realize, I think we just want to stay home and figure out each other. We'll know when it's time to get back to touching the things of nature. And it means like never. We're creators, we're blessed. We get to touch people. Creepy. That's like a superpower.
I was gonna say something similar, like it's just a cocooning time, you know, so that we can block and forth later on and whatever, you know, we decide to do, whether it's music, whether it's just life flow sets, being a life liver, you know, this time, this quiet, this extended vacation helps preserve us and build us up so that when we go back out, you know, we can be the best versions of ourselves that we can be for other people who are having a really hard time, you know, who was hit hard by this.
Okay. I feel really good. I feel hopeful. I want to just pivot real quick. You know, I did not feel this way before Memorial Day, but literally being in spaces where you can share collective frustrations, where you see tangible change in the weeks of people being present in their cities in solidarity for something that's long overdue. Because people have been mad for a long time. This is not necessarily about George Floyd or Breonna Taylor. This is like some people have been mad for a long and they get a space to get out here and kind of like be visible, take it up. Here in DC, we talk a lot about like the comparisons. Last time people felt something like this was, I guess, like the Women's March, but the Women's March didn't really have that kind of tangible change. There weren't policies that changed immediately afterwards. I feel hopeful about where we're going. I am excited by this next generation that's coming up. I think they have the right ideas. I trust them. I know it's weird as shit to a lot of us, but I see how they're using the internet to mobilize, and I see a lot of them are using the internet to kind of like spread this information, and a lot of it's very common sense. They're not here for people's like generational bullshit. They don't want to carry your trauma. They don't want to carry your regressive homophobia. They don't want to carry your racism. Like these white kids are mad. And I'm like, yo. And these are like kids that were about to go wear like bulletproof vests to school and shit, you know? It's wild. It really is nothing, if nothing else, it's a mirror to us as artists. You know, June was really wild for me. My mom and my grandma had COVID Mother's Day of this year. And then Memorial Day happened and we go protest. And then June, Rolling Stone features my band and they're like, yo, this is the artist that you need to watch for June 2020. And like do this whole like documentary and like feature piece on us. The numbers go up and like looks good. And it's like, meanwhile, it's like, there's these contradictions. This pandemic is in my house. Like I'm dealing with this. And it's like, my career is blossoming. I feel so hopeful about what's gonna happen after that. Because there's no way we're living through this and we're letting other generations go through this without being as prepared or without leaving something else. It's about legacy. What are we going to leave? I think we're doing the right things now, and I think it's about to happen. We just got to wake the hell up. That's all it comes down to.
I would say for me, considering the times that we're living in, I feel really fortunate to be an educator right now, because I think it's such an important role to facilitate the conversations and the awakening in the classroom. You know, many teachers and educators don't even have the tools or the knowledge or the foresight to provide or create that space for students. So I'm really fortunate to be in that position, the fact that I can work with the Department of Education to bring my class to other schools across the state and replicate the same thing that I experienced in my classroom, you know, with thousands of other kids. That's amazing to me. So, you know, I'm hopeful about that. And if all else fails, then I'm just waiting on the mothership.
My next guest is Kimberly York. She's president and co-founder of Sohu Enterprises and the interim director of Black Programs at New Mexico State University. Just to let you know, Sohu stands for Serving Supporting Others While Helping Ourselves. Thank you for being on the show with me, Kimberly.
Thank you for this opportunity. I'm grateful to be here.
So you moved to Las Cruces from Cleveland about 5 years ago.
Yes.
You got a background in mentorship. So, you know, how are the needs in Las Cruces different from your hometown?
I'm dating myself here. I grew up in the 70s, and I grew up in an area that's known as Millionaire's Row. Having watched and grown up in such a vibrant neighborhood, predominantly Black neighborhood, middle-class families where we all knew each other and, you know, each person on the street was your surrogate parent, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And then to watch corrupt government come in and poverty increase and watch the city fall into a state of dismay. So you then have students and youth who are left in the trenches of just deplorable conditions and not knowing and not having the resources and the assets that they need to be successful in school. Mm-hmm. And to even better yet understand that this isn't always going to be this way. And so mentorship became important because they needed to have role models in addition to, you know, some students and some youth didn't have parents at home and they were the parents raising their siblings. And so mentorship is an opportunity to provide some stability, number one, but then also serving as a role model and showing them that even though this may be your situation right now, there are other options available.
Now, about a month ago, you were named the interim director of Black Programs down at New Mexico State University.
Yes.
So what's on your mind about what needs to change for students there?
In May of 2020, just this year, 42% of Blacks that were surveyed, including students, rated racial discrimination as a major source of stress. And just 1 month later, 55% mm-hmm. of the people surveyed rated racial discrimination. And so the administration at NMSU has taken a very affirmative stand. They are listening and they are being honest about areas of shortfalls, but also relying on the collaborative efforts of all of us on the campus because the administration is new.
Yeah, okay.
And so they have no control over what has happened prior to. Mm-hmm. They are being responsive in such a way that it feels genuine.
Okay, that's important.
It is. It's very important. We have a long way to go, but we are committed. And I don't like to say, you know, workshops and checking off the box. We can no longer do that.
Yeah.
This is about life work at this point.
Yeah. To that end, you know, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham named you to the state's Council for Racial Justice. That work has not started yet. But what do you hope the council might actually do?
Well, you know, to be honest, it's difficult to say that because the work hasn't been defined yet. It's a large committee and we are all committed to bringing progressive change in our state. I am looking forward to, first and foremost, representing the Office of African American Affairs because I do serve on the executive committee of that office. And so my number one priority is to make sure that the efforts of the Office of African American Affairs are also tied into this collective work.
Thank you so much. She's Kimberly York, president and co-founder of Sohu Enterprises and the interim director of Black Programs at New Mexico State University. This is No More Normal. I'm your host, Khalil Colonna. Catch us on the air Sundays at 11 a.m. here on KUNM or download the show anywhere you get your podcasts. And we are on the internet. Look us up at KUNM.org. My next guest is here to talk about Black August, and she is Monifa Bandele. She is with Movement for Black Lives. Welcome to No More Normal.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yes, of course. Thanks for being with us. So tell us a little bit about Black August. What does it recognize and how is it observed?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really glad that you asked that question. Black August isn't just another Black History Month. Mm-hmm.
Black August comes out of the tradition of celebrating our freedom fighters that specifically come out of the Black Liberation Movement and similar movements across the globe in the wake of the killing of George Jackson in San Quentin Prison. Mm-hmm. And he was an activist in the prisons. The things that he organized around and fought for and demanded just basic human rights. He was killed by prison guards on August 21st of 1971. Mm-hmm. And throughout the entire California prison system, like all the prisons and jails, they began to observe and honor him every year during August by fasting, by studying, and making sure they were carrying on his activist legacy. Mm.
How do you personally observe Black August? Do you have any household traditions built around it?
It's easier to do now because there's not a lot of places to go, but to spend a lot of time together as family. And you can study through political and historical texts, but we also like to read Afrofuturism, reading like Octavia Butler, you know, N.K. Jameson. We have to unlock our collective creativity to reimagine the society we want to build. Like, it doesn't exist yet, right?
Yeah.
To build truly safe and powerful communities. So studying all the traditions of our Black scholars and authors are really key in my household this month.
I like that because that's kind of the premise for this show, No More Normal. We're looking at it like, okay, the normal we knew in January is no longer around. It's not going to come back.
And we're not going back.
We're totally not going back. And it's like, what does the future look like? We have an opportunity to build and shape the future now.
That's right.
I'm also thinking a lot about like ways that we can make ourselves stronger so we can endure what we're facing. Tell me some of the concepts or observations that you've had during Black August that kind of really speak to that.
I've noticed during Black August and during this summer, this pandemic in particular, that we have been able to pass and move policies that were sitting, languishing, couldn't get them through. And it's because people took to the streets and that you cannot change and shift the future without making way, without really seeding the ground and making these things possible. When people took to the streets, we opened up the way.
Yeah.
You know, we made the policymakers have a path forward. Here in New York, a whole suite of stuff that had been languishing in Albany for 5 years, they passed it in like 3 days, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, oh, okay, that's good, because actually that's not enough.
Yeah.
And just the fact that you could meet for 2 days through the threat of physical protests and do these things that are really old reforms for us at this point, shows that anything is possible. So this Black August has us really imagining what is our true North Star and planning for that. Because 6 months ago, we wouldn't have known that we could have repealed the police secrecy law and see their disciplinary records, you know, or our special prosecutor bill that passed. It was like, oh my God, this is going to take forever and ever and ever.
Yeah.
So now we've got the win against our backs.
Yeah.
That's what this Black August has taught us. And so when we meet, you see people talking about things and setting goals, not based on what's politically feasible, but what is just. So that's been a big shift this Black August.
I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and letting us know a lot more about Black August. She is Monifa Bandele. She is with Movement for Black Lives. Thanks for so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Next week, we look at ICE detention facilities in the time of COVID and what people are doing to try and stop human rights violations there. That's about all the time we have for this week. Music for the show provided by A. Billy Free, Fellow Fader, Jazz Tone the Producer, Cheo, Dom Life, Fresh Air, and Olad Records. Shout out to Flow Fader for remixing our music panel. Khaki, Pope Yes Yes Y'all, and Bigawatt composed some of the show's themes. Thanks to Black Astronaut for providing the artwork for this episode. To see it, just go to this show's post online at KUNM.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Thanks to Nash Jones for their contributions, and thank you Ty Bannerman for the editing help. No More Normal is brought to you by Your New Mexico Government, a collaboration between KUNM, New Mexico PBS, and the Santa Fe Reporter. Funding for our coverage comes from the New Mexico Local News Fund, the Kellogg Foundation, and KUNM listeners like you. Support for public media provided by the Thornburg Foundation. No More Normal is executive produced by Marisa DeMarco, produced and hosted by yours truly. I'm Khalil A. Colonna. For everyone here at No More Normal HQ, thanks for listening.